This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Anchor. If you don't know what Anchor is and you're thinking about starting a podcast, you should probably find out what Anchor is, because Anchor is a free way to host your podcasts. It also gives you creation tools like the ability to record yourself, record with other people, edit as well, and do it from your phone or your computer. You don't need to go buy fancy tools to start. You can start with Anchor. And you can hit the nice distribute button, and it's going to send it out to all the places you want it to be, like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, and more. In addition to that, you can make money from your podcast with no basic listenership. In other words, if you only have 10 people because you're just starting, you can still monetize that. It's really hard to find a better place to start. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm and get started on the crazy podcast journey.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Fighting through technology once again. Seems yep. like we do that every week in some weird fashion.
I know. For the listeners this week, you may notice a difference in sound. Lam and I are not in the room together anymore. We are experimenting with Skype recording for the convenience so that Lam doesn't have to drive cross town in traffic to do this every week. And we just spent about, half hour? 40 minutes?
Yeah, probably about half hour. Yeah, easily.
Testing recording volumes and microphones and all the things that neither of us know how to do. another thing we should mention before we go any further, we're not hearing it, but all the listeners just heard our new theme song, which I included in the recording of last week, but we didn't know that at the time that we recorded. So thank you to Giovanni, a.k.a. Cruels, for such a kick-ass song.
Yeah, I'm shocked. Did you collaborate with him on that one?
He just had me send him a couple pieces of guitar, but I mean, like, all the hard work was him.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Like I said in the description of, I think it was in the description of last week's show, I said it was kind of like the crappy guitar player in the garage band on the street getting to work with Quincy Jones. He's just a musical genius.
Yeah, it's kind of sad that he's not in the Bay Area anymore. Outside of him being a musical genius, he was one of my golf buddies. So now I don't have one of my golf buddies back in the area again.
That's right. You guys are the golf buds. Yeah, he's out there playing with Bo now.
Yeah, Bo Roulette and a couple of other random people.
Yep. So, what happened to you this week, man? Anything interesting?
Yeah, I ran into my dad twice. Completely unannounced, which is odd, because I just don't picture my dad as hanging out in the same places as I do. So that was, I'm not sure if that's better for him or worse for me.
Was it like a shock or just, you know, normal thing?
It was a little shocking because he had gone out to New York to visit my sister, and then he came back, and he came back early, so we didn't know he was back here. Then I ran into him at a coffee shop and at the driving range, so it was kind of strange.
That's random.
Yeah.
Oh, let's see. Well, I'm trying to think of, it's been such a crazy week. And I don't know, I think sometimes I talked about this a minute in, I think it's today's vlog. Doing the vlogging, it really makes my week surreal, man. Like, I have no idea what day it is, and I'm trying to remember things, and I'm like, that happened yesterday? No, that happened 2 days ago, but I think it was yesterday because I was editing the video of it yesterday. Time just, like, all my days bleed together now.
Yeah, it's really strange because I remember watching your vlog and you were talking about working in the present, thinking a day behind because you're still, you know, editing and looking at your footage from the day before and then releasing stuff from the day before. So you're operating in two different tenses at the same time, which is, that's got to be weird.
Yeah, it's a strange thing, but I think, I don't know, like I said it in there as well, I think I like it. Something about it, it's a weird thing to say, but it almost makes me more present because I can't focus on the past or all the other stuff in the same way. So it all becomes the past and the present mixed together. So I kind of feel like I'm more in the now.
Do you find yourself remembering things better because you have to relive them so many times?
No, I don't remember anything anymore.
that's the reverse effect of that of what will happen to you. That's strange.
Yeah, it becomes a weird like loop. I don't know. Like I think what happens is I try to remember something, and then because I can't place it to a specific day, it just ends up like spinning out, and then I just end up not remembering.
Oh, geez. What about the stuff you do on a daily basis? Does it change? Does having a camera constantly on you and filming everything that you do change the way you do things?
No, not at all. I mean, it's not always on me, obviously. Like, I'm very... The one thing about doing a vlog as opposed to, I think, not... I don't know, because I've never done it. But being in a reality TV show or having a camera crew follow you for a documentary, I'm in control of what's included and what's captured and what's not. So that doesn't really change anything, but I do think that because of the change in temporality, I have rely on paper and apps a lot more to remember, you know, like, oh, I need to do this today. Oh, that's today. Okay. Thank you for reminding me, Todoist.
Yeah, but is that a dual-edged thing, though? Like, I mean, when you plan your tasks for the day, for example, like I was kind of curious about this while I was watching your vlog. Like, do you plan tasks with the intention of having purposeful things to film, or do you just literally take a day in the life of?
Depends on the day. I mean, there's no consistency in general. Some days I know if I know something's going to happen, I will wait to record. You know, like I won't worry about finding something to record or talk about. For example, you know, like the day that you came over last week to record the podcast, I didn't really record anything before you came over. So I'm like, Lamb is the vlog today. And, but then other days I just fall into things. I mean, like I recorded basically a vlog and a half the other day because I was halfway through something and then John came over and I went on an adventure with him. So I'm like, oh, here's a whole vlog just of that.
Yeah. It's the Home Depot adventure, right?
Yeah. I end up with so many pieces of things that I don't even get to use because you don't know what happens until you edit. Editing your life.
How has that affected, like, because I know you're a pretty heavy journal person. So I have no idea what that word actually is, but
I feel like journaler would be right, but it feels weird.
Yeah, it feels weird. It doesn't roll off the tongue properly. But do you find that affects how much you journal or how you journal?
I feel like before, I kind of fell off of the journaling in the sense of like putting down my thoughts. Mm-hmm. I mean, the most of the journaling I do now is more commonplace book stuff, right, where I write down, you know, what I'm watching, if I have any thoughts about what I'm watching or what I'm reading. That's still the same. What I have noticed though is it makes social media almost irrelevant, sure, because I was like, I have very little to express there that I'm not already expressing. So finding a place for those things other than, you know, posting links to the stuff I'm doing is hard, and trying not to bore people, especially Snapchat, because I mean, the whole way I ended up in this vlogging thing was screwing around with Snapchat, and I was essentially vlogging on Snapchat. Mm-hmm. So now I don't know what the hell to do on there.
Well, that's true. I mean, you basically have three forms of immediate media that you're publishing to the world. Like, pretty much, I mean, the vlog you publish every single day, which I'm still astounded by, but I mean, your vlogs are between, you know, 5 and 10 minutes every day. How do you come up with enough material to throw in there?
Well, sometimes I'm not sure. It's a struggle every day, but and I think that's part of the adventure. You know, I think sometimes I overthink it, and I realize I'm like, why do I have to worry about that? And just point the camera and talk and figure it out afterwards. I mean, believe it or not, you know, like when I get to the end of the day, usually I'll drop everything into Premiere, and it's like usually about 38 clips.
Yeah.
And then just when you shave everything down, you're like, and here's 5 minutes.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I mean, it's funny because the vlogs feels very much like, in a roundabout kind of way, it feels very much like what your main character or one of the versions of your main character in the novel that you're writing would do. Like it feels Charlie-ish in its sensibility. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I kind of feel like there's not even a loose tie, but a pretty direct tie to how Charlie works in your brain versus how your brain is using vlogging as a way to catalog itself. You know what I mean?
I think the strange thing about that book is I started that book with the idea of creating a character who had nothing to do with me. And then over the past few years, he slowly changed me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't know. Like, here's a question for you. So photography, right?
Yeah.
And Instagram. I think in a way there's a correlation between what we're talking about with, you know, like my journaling, writing, and then vlogging, another outlet, you know, but it's a very public outlet, something that you're doing on a regular basis. When you started using Instagram to share photography, how did that change your photography, or how did it view the purposes you took things and the devices you used?
Well, it's weird because, you know, at the very beginning, it's something that we touched on in one of the previous podcasts. You know, at first it was just a way for me to display my artwork or my photography. And then eventually it became, you know, me purposefully looking for cool images to take in order to, you know, fulfill some sort of need for social validation. And now I think I've gone the complete opposite direction where now I'm barely displaying anything, especially on Instagram. So it's tough because there's a part of me that feels like I'm now disconnected from my photography as well as from the people in my life because I don't use Instagram that much.
Mm-hmm.
So it's weird how it's come full circle in that sense. I feel more isolated now than I ever have before. And the irony of that is when I was using Instagram for photography, I felt connected, but I wasn't really connected. So there's kind of a weird dichotomy there. Like, it, ultimately, they both kind of feel the same, but they both kind of feel the same for completely different reasons.
Is there a reason that you specifically stopped using it as much?
Yeah, it was just a lot of upkeep, in the sense that, and which is both good and bad for an artist. Like, I felt like I constantly had to replenish the images. But the problem with that is it made me feel like I was just doing it for the sake of doing it versus doing something that was actually creative or interesting. So it kind of felt like every single day I had a deadline and I had to meet that deadline. And I guess that isn't necessarily a bad thing, but part of the reason why photography means what it means to me is because I want to do it when I want to do it and not because I have to do it. You know what I mean?
Right. I think that's a important delineation there. Like, for example, like the vlog, I don't worry about that because I don't view what I'm doing as for vlogging. I don't view it as art.
Yeah.
So there's no, so the deadline's fine for me. That pressure is a good thing for me. It keeps me productive. It keeps me creating, but it's not encroaching upon some kind of, artistic sensibility. Whereas like, I felt a similar thing with trying to sell art online. After I tried, you know, getting the process where I'm like, oh, I need more followers and I need to make more sales. And it just started making me not want to draw.
Sure.
So I get you on that for sure. I do think that public sensibility can, at least for you and I, diminish that drive.
What about the personal sensibilities though? I mean, the personal deadlines. Like, I know that when you were writing Charlie, you used to give yourself, you know, deadlines to achieve certain things within either the story itself or the outlines. But there was also, you've also, you know, published a couple of books of poetry. And I mean, when it comes to publishing a book, for example, like, how strictly do you enforce deadlines for yourself? And how do you define that process in order to you know, make sure that you're fulfilling those obligations to yourself in order to create something?
Well, I feel like the novel and a and poetry, a book of poetry, are very different beasts, at least for me. Particularly the main poetry book, Erectile Dysfunction, that was very Bukowski style driven. It's very brutal in its verbiage. You know, there's not a lot of perfecting of the phrases. I mean, there is behind, but it doesn't come across that way. It's a very simple, aggressive form of poetry, I would say. And so for that, I relied on impulse. I'd sit down to write something, and if it didn't come out pretty much in a solid chunk.
Yeah.
I mean, afterwards I would edit and, you know, make sure I got the right word here and there. But if the piece as itself didn't come out in one chunk, then I'd throw away whatever I was working on. I had one particular piece and I was spending like an hour and I'm like, wait a minute. No. This is not how this book works. So I threw that piece away. Whereas with the novel, it's just a matter of I have to set deadlines to get things done because I can't do it all in one chunk. I can't run on that same drive. Sure. So I find myself, actually, this gives me a good opportunity to bring in a new application that I discovered for my phone into the discussion. By the way, people really enjoyed some of the technology talk that we did, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I'm trying this new app. It's called Strides. And it's a habit tracker. For a while, I was tracking habits within my Todoist, which is my main task management app. And that's just not, it's not the right tool for that. Is when you track habits, obviously there needs to be flexibility for not doing it. With a task manager, if I put write for 1 hour on Monday and I don't get it done on Monday, then it's still there on Tuesday. And the moment I complete that, then it'll make me, you know, it'll say, oh, now you need to do Tuesdays. And that's just, it's not the right tool. So this is more something where I can say, for example, I'm looking at it right now. I have the reminder to try to drink 8 glasses of water a day. So whatever I get to at the end, that's how many I drank for the day. It doesn't, you know, I don't need to get to 8 to complete it. Specifically to write Charlie. At this point, with the amount of work that I'm doing on all this other stuff, including this podcast, I have Write Charlie 3 times a week. I try to get, and if I can get to myself back to the schedule of at least writing him 3 times a week, then the next step would be to bump that up to 4, then to 5. And then, of course, I've added in here, you know, awesome things that we all need in our lives, like meditate, read, and remember to floss. Because I hate flossing, but I need to do it all the time.
Yeah, I feel you on the same way. I floss maybe twice a week. I mean, Crystal is so diligent about flossing, it's terrifying. She flosses at least twice a day. It's unbelievable.
She probably has perfect teeth.
Oh, her teeth are immaculate. It's ridiculous. I mean, if there's some kind of crazy nuclear apocalypse, like it's going to be cockroaches in her teeth, basically.
Unbelievable. That's a state that I want to be in. My problem is, this is strange to say, I have a very small mouth. I'm a loud person, but my jaw does not open very wide. Like I have like a less than 2-inch clearance between my teeth.
Oh, I think you told me about this at some point. Yeah, I've never seen you open your mouth really big.
I can't.
I'm looking at your mouth to watch you open it.
I'd have to break my jaw to do it. I mean, literally, I have like, I'm trying right now. I think it's about a 1¼-inch clearance. Yeah. So flossing is evil for me. I can't, you know, like you can get your fingers in there. I'm like, I can fit 2 fingers maximum in my mouth at a time. Mm-hmm. So I've been using these little pick things. They're flossing picks. I don't know what the hell they're called because I don't have the package here. But they look like little pine trees.
Oh, yeah. I've seen those, actually. I used to use those.
Those have been a lot of help because I can get those into places that I could not get normal floss. So that has made getting that job done easier. I avoid it less now. They're worth trying, man. I don't know... Haven't talked to the dentist to find out if they work as well, but I figure it can't hurt. I also have a water pick that I play around with every once in a while.
Yeah, that thing's more entertaining than it is useful, though. Like, I like to spray things from distance just to see if I can knock them over. That's basically it.
I feel like I can never get it lined up on the gum right to where I'm like, it's nailing the spot that it should be nailing.
Yeah. But just to go back on some of the technology stuff, too, I mean, it's now the third podcast in a row that we've talked about Hound, and I feel like our conversation about Hound evolves as the podcast does. I had a chance to use Hound over the course of last week, and I will tell you, it is one of the most incredible apps I've ever used in my life.
It's mind-blowing, isn't it?
It's unbelievable. And just to mess with it, I would do, you know, just crazy unrelated strings of questions, and then I would ask a follow-up a couple of minutes later to one of the questions that was in the string, and it was smart enough to figure out what the heck I was talking about. It's unbelievable. I still am shocked at how they do it.
I'm shocked that Apple hasn't been throwing billions of dollars at them to inject that into Siri, because honestly, Siri really is lacking in comprehension.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the guys at Back to Work were talking about this too, is that I think the next step in a lot of this technology is, and we talk about context a lot for a lot of different things, but I think that having these apps, like these dictation apps or these personal assistant apps, understand context, once they can do that, then it's a whole different ballgame. And I think that personal assistants on phones can become so much more useful. Like even the using Siri to make a checklist, for example. Like, I mean, that's something I just recently discovered how to do. And like a checkmarkable checklist. And that's one of the coolest things that I've ever figured out on my phone. I know it sounds really rudimentary and really simple, but I mean, in previous incarnations, it's like the first conversation we had about this stuff. If I have to open two folders and two apps and change three settings to do something, I'm just going to write it on a piece of paper. You know what
right.
I mean?
I mean, that's what I do.
Yeah.
And then I log this stuff later. I think that's the one obstacle to Hound is you have to open Hound.
Yeah, yeah.
And I ended up deleting it just because I'm like, this is really cool and it's awesome, but I'm just not going to use it.
Sure.
I don't look for that kind of information. And I think I am trained to do things via typing. So it takes a lot of training to get me to remember that I can just ask something. Like, I have the Google search app in my dock. And I type it in. I still never talk to it.
Yeah.
Like, ever.
Well, I think the only way that technology really becomes useful, especially for guys like you and me, is if I can just talk to my phone. I know that sounds kind of crazy, but I can just say, hey, Siri, you know, I need to find a vegetarian restaurant in San Francisco. And I don't have to click on anything. I don't have to touch anything. I don't have to activate an app or do anything like that. You know what I mean? It just literally knows that I'm talking to it.
And right.
That would be amazing.
Like Alexa.
Like Alexa, except like Alexa, you can't carry an obelisk around with you everywhere you go.
I think that the one thing that separates all the attempts that they're making right now from the ultimate goal, which is the Star Trek computer, is that conversational ability to be able to ask a question in 15 different ways and not have to use a specific formula like you have to do with Siri. And also context, like you said, you know, for it to understand those things so that you can, at a certain point, I know that they will get that language capability up to where you can say, can you find me a book about the Middle East conflict prior to the English invasion of, you know, whatever, and then it's going through and it's starting to give you suggestions. You go, no, I want to view it from the other side, you know, to where you can use that conversation. To help it narrow your search results down like you would with a human.
Do you think it needs to get to the point where, and I don't even, this is some Skynet stuff we're talking about now, but I mean, what if, do you think it really needs to get to a point where it learns you well enough to understand what you're trying to say?
To a certain degree, but I think less than people think regarding like preferences and more regarding language usage.
Sure.
You know, like when I say, hey, play me, you know, if I were to say something and I use the word dig, like give me something I dig. Like, it knows that I use the word dig for like, and it understands that. Those, I think those are far more important than, you know, like, he likes to eat chicken on Tuesdays, because nobody is that, well, hopefully nobody's that regimented. So, I'm not.
I mean, the guys over at Back to Work were mentioning stuff like, you know, if, what are they called? I think they're called geofences. A concept in these personal assistants where, or these digital assistants where it understands by both proximity, geography, and time what you would want to do or need to do. On the example that they gave was, you know, so John goes home from work every day at 5 o'clock, and right before he leaves his office, he needs to remember to grab his mail key. And so the device knows that, okay, so John's packing up, he's getting ready to go, and as he walks out the door, you know, the phone will remind you, hey, did you remember your mail key? And I think something like that would be pretty remarkable. I mean, the concept of geofences is not really a new concept.
No, not at all.
Up until this point, I don't think the technology has just been good enough to get a tight enough bead on where you are geographically in order to make it useful. But I think we get pretty close to that.
I feel like going back to context, I also think that the ultimate goal there would be to have a machine that understands that you are leaving work, but that you did not grab the key. So that doesn't remind you when you do have it.
Sure. Because I imagine that reminder gets annoying after about the ninth day when you have your key.
Right, yeah, because I've done stuff like that where it's like, you know, for a while, I would forget to write down when I leave the house. Because I always, in my journal, in my commonplace book, journal, whatever we want to call it, I track whatever I do as well. You know, like, oh, John and I went to Home Depot. Even though I have the vlog, I'm not going to go back to the vlog and remember what I did that day. So I write those things down. So I used to have a reminder, a geolocation reminder in Todoist that would say, write down where you're going, and any time that it knew I was leaving the house. That got annoying really fast.
Sure, I can imagine.
And to a certain point where I'm like, I don't care. If I forget, I forget. I think it's not that important to me.
Sure. Well, so we kind of went through what I did over the course of last week. What the heck have you been doing other than going to Home Depot?
I don't know. Hold on. Let me go watch my vlog.
Do you think they've just kind of replaced your memory in that sense, and that's why you can't remember anything anymore?
I feel like the vlogs are my short-term memory now.
Wow, crazy.
I'm just giving all of you my short-term memory.
That is slightly terrifying.
I'm a stoner without the stone.
Yeah, I wonder if, you know, we're talking about like artists, you know, I wonder if movie directors think that way. Like, they, you know, they, so basically the movies operate as their long-term memory, because obviously for them, when they're making a movie, there's so much that goes on in the background that's part of their associative memory, that, you know, seeing someone place a bottle on a table could bring back a whole sequence of things that happened over the course of a month. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, and you also, I think that what I'm experiencing is probably something that they definitely experience on the set, because, you know, they're not filming everything chronologically either. So they're keeping the chronology straight in their mind. They're remembering pieces. They're going, okay, we got to shoot this over here because this goes to this. Okay, we got to shoot this over here because that's going to this. And then, that's why when people say all the time, you know, like, oh, why do they have so many continuity errors in this movie? Mm-hmm. Because that's the way they're filming things. You know, like, you might not remember, oh, we forgot the cigarette was at 50% last time we filmed. We need to burn it down to 50% before we start filming again.
Sure.
So I definitely think that that's something that they experience. I also think it's other than just like the short term memory thing, I also think it's confusion. Sure. Our brain's not meant to handle that kind of temporality.
Yeah. Yeah. That much sensory input to that level of detail in that chronological order. Sure. Sure.
Yeah, it's a burnout, essentially. You know, the brain's just going off.
It's funny that because I didn't really realize how that worked until, you know, we work with a bunch of people who work in film, and or who are just videographers. So I get to see them shoot things out of sequence, and I don't understand how they can keep it all straight. You know what I mean? Like, there are so many things that happen out of order. And you have to keep the entire narrative in your head, and so many bits of the narrative are happening at different times that I'm actually shocked that there aren't more continuity errors in movies. You know what I mean? So I have a weird appreciation for when I see a movie. Like tonight, we're going to see this really terrifying this horror movie called The Witch. And apparently most of that was shot in sequence. So I'm curious to see the difference between a movie shot in sequence and a movie shot out of sequence. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think when I was younger, I spent a lot of time when I was younger, like, working on what I thought were scripts, you know. The only reason I say that is because I never finished anything, so it's not really a script. But I spent a lot of time playing with that stuff. And in my mind, it was always like, it seemed like, oh, it's so easy. Just shoot it in sequence. Just do it in order. But I do think that there's an inherent difficulty to certain things where it's like, sure, you could shoot it in order, but it's going to take you 50 days instead of 20. Because we have this scene already set up, so we should shoot everything that takes place in this room. And to have a brain that does that and to, obviously there's training involved, it's impressive to me. It really is. But now that I've gone through and done something that I didn't think was possible to do, which is cutting these and editing them, or cutting them, filming them and cutting them every day, I do think that we can all learn anything.
Sure.
It's just a matter of whether we'll stick with it.
Well, it's one of those, it's going back to last week's podcast too. I think that's part of the reason why we see so few errors in continuity when it comes to TV shows, because they shoot them in sequence. So yeah. That kind of makes sense, you know?
With the exception of, check this out, Law and Order. It's not on the air anymore, but one version of it is. But they do not shoot in sequence. In fact, they shoot multiple episodes at the same time.
Whoa, that's confusing.
So imagine being that actor where it's like, okay, I can't remember who was saying it. I feel like I want to say it was Mariska Hargitay.
Yeah.
I think it's Hargitay. Yeah. I feel like it was her talking about Special Victims Unit. But they go into, you know, one scene. They're filming, we'll say, episode 55. Yeah. And they're going in. They're in a courtroom. Okay, courtroom scene. That's their scene for that show right now. Okay, cut. All right, you need to go over to set two because we're working on episode 57. And in episode 57, you're making a bust. Okay, so they got to go over there, and now they got to do that scene. And then you got to run over to the other set because now episode 56, which is in between the two, is filming. Now they have the set for, whatever, the station house. And they've got to go into those scenes and, you know, like pull up this piece of paper and be like, okay, what is my character feeling right now? Mm-hmm. And what happened before this? Oh, I filmed that other one. That technically happened. I filmed the other one before. But that technically happens after this, so I don't know that. So I can't show that right now.
Wow. Yeah, how do you reset your memory like that? That's crazy. Because, yeah, there are certain details that you just don't know as the character from the day before.
I feel like to some degree, I mean, obviously I don't know, but I feel like there's got to be somebody whose job it is to write down all the pertinent details for them. Like,
oh, sure.
Here's what you need to know. By the way, your character doesn't know this yet. You know, like there's... Gotta be somebody.
You haven't met this guy yet, or you haven't gone to this place yet. Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, like, oh, well, you looked like your face showed that you were familiar with him. You're supposed to be surprised.
Sure, sure. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's genius, though. I mean, credit to television actors. Perhaps they don't get enough credit for what they do.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious as to, you know, I don't know why I've never thought of it until now, but, like, I'm curious as to how they shot 24. Remember that show?
Yeah, but I never watched it, so.
Yeah, I mean, I watched a couple of episodes. It's supposed to be, it was more gimmick than it was quality in that sense. I mean, there were some good moments in the show, but ultimately it was just one giant gimmick. And a lot of things, I knew that they, you know, they must have filmed that show over a number of months, but all of that's supposed to happen in a 24-hour period, so.
That's each season, right?
Yeah, each season is a 24-hour day. So from that perspective, it's the opposite of what we think of when it comes to like movies. Because if you take like, you know, any take like The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. I mean, that movie is supposed to take place over a lifetime, but it was filmed in 6 months. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's really interesting to see how time works so differently. And it's, you're right. Like, I don't think I don't think most of us in the general populace understand how difficult that might be for an actor to jump through so many periods of time and so many gaps of time so quickly and maintain the character that's appropriate for that given moment in time, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's maybe even until this moment right now, I never even thought about it as much as I am.
Yeah, that's crazy.
You know, I want to go back to Instagram for a second. I have a question for you.
Sure.
Did you hear the news about Instagram?
I did not.
Instagram has announced that they will now be instituting the Facebook, or not the, but a Facebook style algorithm to where your feed will no longer be chronological.
Oh, that's annoying.
Colin's really pissed off about it.
Yeah, that sounds completely not useful to me as a person and or as a business. How the heck is that supposed to work for a business? That doesn't make any sense.
I think it's the same thing that they did with the fan pages, right? They want you to pay. And Colin did a really good experiment. I have my plane in air. I have my phone in airplane mode, so I can't really pull this up to look at the exact numbers. But he put something up on his Instagram last night of, oh, you know what? I can pull it up on the computer. Of his, what happens on Facebook for him, whether he boosts something or he doesn't, and relates directly back to what we were talking about last week with it, how it didn't do anything for me with the vlog, paying Facebook ad. Him, drastically different results. I just pulled it up right now. Okay, so his non-boosted post, I don't know how many likers he has on his page, but on a non-boosted post, it reaches 1,558 people.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming he has at least 1,558 people that like his page. Drastically more, I'm sure. He received 6 likes and 1 comment. The boosted post reached 72,411 people.
Whoa.
So that is a 70% increase. Yeah, 70% increase. And he received 4,516 likes, 5 comments, and 44 shares.
Wait. He got... So what? How much was the non-boosted post?
In which category?
How many views did he get with the non-boosted post?
The 1,558.
No, that's a way higher percentage than 70%, dude.
No, 700% maybe.
Yeah, exactly. So that's insane. Wow.
And then his likes. I mean, the drastic difference. That's like a, I don't even know what that increase is from 6 to 4,516 likes.
Yeah, that's exponential. So, I mean, that's unbelievable.
There is a, at least on the likes, I will say this. I don't think this is responsible for much difference, but there is a difference, mild difference in the two things he posted in the sense that, the non-boosted post was a t-shirt with his, artwork on it. And the other one was an original piece of artwork. But they were both exactly the same piece.
Ah, interesting.
Which is the tentacles under the glass jar lid.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
But I don't think that the minor differences in what is in the photo is responsible for the difference in the likes. So you're looking at, I don't know how much he paid to boost that for his test. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming he paid a drastic amount because the levels grow in exponentially. I spent $10 and it went out to about 1,500 people. So I'm guessing he might have spent, we'll say like $50. Okay. Now say you're spending $50 every time you post something on Facebook and you're posting, I don't know, 5 times a week. That's $250 a week. Now, all of a sudden, if you have to start doing that on Instagram, now all of a sudden you're spending $500 a week. Is it worth it?
Honestly, I think that it's just oversaturation, man. I mean, and that's, this may be short-sighted of me. I don't think I may have an incomplete read on this from a practicality standpoint, but like I watch Crystal do the same thing with her businesses, and I think it's not necessarily about the amount of money you spend as it is about how smart you're targeting.
Right.
You know, so I think like with Crystal, for example, I mean, there are certain ads that she's put up where she's spent $5 and gotten great results, and others where she's spent $50 and gotten crap results. You know what I mean? So most of that came down to targeting, as well as, and to some extent, the quality of the post itself. Another example I have of that is for my own Instagram for the golf company. So, you know, I typically get, you know, maybe 500 to 1,000 views per video, which, by the way, on Instagram, I'm starting to like that more and more when it comes to the views, because it shows the reach that your videos are getting.
Right.
I kind of like to see what that looks like for images. But so, yeah, I usually get between 5 to 1,500 or 5 to 1,000 500 to 1,000 views per video. But on this latest one, where I'm doing this weird swing drill that's apparently more impressive than I thought it was, I got 11,000 views, and those are all organic. Like, I didn't pay for a single one of those.
Yeah, I do. I believe that, I mean, in the long run, what we're all looking for is genuine traffic, right?
Sure.
The truest way to get genuine traffic is organically, always. But the amount of work that it takes to get those things sometimes, you know, like, some of us don't want to do it. Sure. And I'm not saying that Colin does or Colin doesn't. I think that he was proving a point about the monetization of this whole process, because I have problems with the Facebook fan page thing, even though, like, I personally, I don't care.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't affect me in any way. I could care less. But I do think that there's something brutal about the fact that, you know, I will say that he has 1,558 fans on his page, right? And he posts something and it only goes out to 12.
Yeah.
That's messed up, because somebody did all of that work getting those people to like that page, and now you're going to try to make them pay for that. Obviously, they're offering this for free. They can charge us for whatever they want. But I do think that there's a sinisterness to that business plan. And to know that Instagram's going to start doing that to people, it's messed up. And I know Colin's point on the post, by the way, I should mention to the listeners, is there is a petition, I believe, that people can sign. Change.org. Go to change.org for Keep Instagram Chronological. So anybody wants to check that out. To me, personally, I'm very excited about the Instagram algorithm, because now the 5 likes that I get for everything I post will now become 0 likes, and then I can just delete the damn app. It's one less thing for me to worry about in my life.
Yeah, it goes past the point of usefulness for you. It's just gone now.
I don't care about it. It doesn't mean, and I have, you know, like,
yeah.
Only thing I care about is YouTube and this. These are my two main things. I don't care about everything else. Whatever. I will say this. Yeah. Going back to another thing we talked about previously, Facebook and me saying Facebook bites, I might have to eat my words, man. Facebook fan pages still bite. Right. But personal, yeah. Facebook pages, wow. 80 to 90% of my vlog traffic is coming from my personal Facebook page.
No kidding.
Part of that's responsible to me knowing awesome people, but wow, shocking.
Yeah, I would have never guessed. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's a drastic. By the way, YouTube's statistics or analytics are brilliant. They're so detailed. Yeah. If you really wanted to go crazy, yeah, you could. But I think it's 80 to 90%. Of every post, like, consistently. So,
wow, that's shocking.
I'm eating crow right now. But once again, I do think that a lot of what we were talking about was the Facebook fan page, personal pages. I'm wondering though how long until they start seeing that as an ad revenue, you know, make people pay to boost their personal posts.
Yeah, I think that it's such a slippery slope for a company like Facebook, because if you try to over monetize, then you end up just losing people in droves. You know what I mean? And I think that there's a certain buy-in or adoptability you need among a strong user base in order to make a tool like that viable for a business. You know what I mean? Like if 20 people, imagine if someone tried to monetize MySpace like 4 years ago, you know what I mean? It just wouldn't work, but there's nobody there anymore. You know what I mean? It's like having the best sale in the world in an empty store, you know?
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, I think that there's still a use for, I mean, I actually know of quite a few companies that have used Facebook pages well, fan pages well. But that's it. For every one good example, I have four bad examples. You know what I mean? And I'm not sure if it's just purely a demographic thing, like that particular company that I saw that is successful on Facebook has a user base that is just on Facebook a lot, mm-hmm. or if it's something, the way that they're producing content in order to make it so that people are continually going back to the page. You know what I mean?
I definitely think that you make a very valid point there, in the sense that, just because one thing is successful in one place does not mean that it will be successful in, or something else will be successful in that same space with the same strategy.
Sure.
An artist on Facebook might struggle a lot more than a golf page, or vice versa. Maybe an artist rocks on Facebook because that's what people on Facebook want to see, and they don't want to see golf.
Sure.
Or clothing or anything else. Like, I mean, obviously there's the degree of, like you said, targeting your audience correctly. You know, okay, I am selling this type of product. Who buys this type of product? Okay, 40 to 50-year-old women in the United States. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's more targeting than that involved, but knowing that that's where they are. Okay, well, where are 40 to 50-year-old women in the United States? What social media do they use? And I think that's a form of targeting that people don't use often enough, is to find the right location first.
Sure. The two sides of that I see are basically, like, if you look at a company that doesn't specifically have a product but focuses on a certain type of product or a certain demographic, are usually the ones that are successful. Like the one that pops to mind is Uncrate, which is a company that basically just has really snazzy, cool, futuristic toys for, you know, a certain male demographic between 30 and 50. You know what I mean? Like, that page is vastly successful, but I can imagine from the other side of the same equation, like, if there was a page that just did specifically like ties, I can't really see that specific of a niche having enough content to maintain a user base over a long period of time. You know
right.
I mean?
Yeah. You think, okay, I'm selling ties. Facebook, maybe where you want to be is LinkedIn.
Yeah.
You know?
or one of the most successful, one of my friends, one of the most successful versions of that I've seen, one of my friends runs a jewelry company out of San Diego. And her best marketing channel is Pinterest by far, and it's like a 90-10 split between everything else and Pinterest.
I feel like almost anything in that, in the product field, you know, like you're selling from clothing to clocks to anything, should be rocking on Pinterest, because I'm gonna admit it right now, I don't use it very often, but Pinterest is rad. Like, the way it's set up, and if that's the type of stuff you're looking for, there is no better place to find that stuff. It all the other stuff is cut out. You know, there's messaging on there. Nobody uses it, as far as I know. So you're just basically looking at a stream of stuff that you like.
Yeah.
And I think that I can't imagine why people don't talk about Pinterest more, to be honest.
Well, not only that, I think it's not just a... Sure, it's just a stream of stuff that you like, but the greatest thing that I think in Pinterest and how I see certain businesses use it is that you can compartmentalize the things that you like. Like, when I was experimenting with Pinterest for myself and some of the stuff that I was doing, like, I had a section for art, I had it broken down to like street art, sculpture, photography. So I had it all broken down into individual compartments. And say today I just really felt like looking at Scandinavian architecture, I could literally just go to a board that had nothing but Scandinavian architecture and I could fulfill my need for that. And I don't know why no other environment like Facebook, for example, does that. Like, I don't know if it's just because the interface isn't conducive to it or because the platform won't allow for that level of specificity, but I really like that about Pinterest.
Yeah, I think that the one thing that they've nailed is that ability to dial in your feed. I think to some degree, people get the same experience with Tumblr. But I think I think part of the reason, it's not necessarily the fault of the other apps. It's the way that people view those apps and the way that we do things on there. Like Pinterest, you don't have to, you know, there's not the same obligation to follow everybody that you know.
Sure.
You don't have to follow anybody you know. It's Pinterest. Nobody cares. There's no communication going on there. So people don't view it the same way. Whereas, you know, like Facebook, you know, like your best friend sends you a request on Facebook. If you don't accept it, you're an asshole. Whereas on Pinterest, Pinterest, you know, like you both might be on there and not even know each other are on there because, you know, you're busy looking at the stuff you're into. There's not the same social obligation, I think, to a site like that. And I would say to a certain degree with Tumblr as well.
Isn't that kind of what the intention was with Instagram originally, though? I mean, sure, you could follow your friends and stuff, but I mean, most of the people I follow or who are following me on my Instagram aren't friends of mine. I don't know any of these people. You know what I mean? But we share a common interest in a common environment. You know what I mean?
I definitely think that that was the original, at least the original way that Instagram was used. But once people started, once the whole selfie phenomenon started, that changed everything. The selfie and the food thing changed everything because then it became a more social medium. And let's be honest. What did Instagram become? Instagram became the photo feed of Facebook. Like 80 to 90% of the people who post photos on Facebook are using Instagram to do it.
Sure.
It's Facebook's photo app.
Yeah, over time, I've gotten to the point where for me, it's either one or the other and never both. You know what I mean? Like, if I'm on Instagram a lot, I'm barely ever on Facebook. And if I'm on Facebook a lot, I'm barely looking at Instagram.
Right. I mean, there's a few rare individuals that have the ability to like pictures on Instagram and like the same picture when they see it again on Facebook. And those are just very generous people. Most people don't have the patience to do that. Sure.
Yeah, I know. These days I rarely do. You know what I mean? Unless it's a really, really close friend, I find myself not doing that very often. So, yeah.
Something I find interesting, too, is I think that to some degree that phenomena that we're talking about also happens on YouTube. And do you consider YouTube a social media?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think it flip-flops because I think that there are certain people on YouTube whose channels are very interactive, you know, where they're commenting all the time, where they're doing, you know, videos back and forth with other YouTubers and stuff like that. But I think for the most part, it's not. I think it's very anonymous. You know, most of the videos that go viral, for example, are videos that, I mean, you don't know the publisher. You don't know the person who edited or created that video. You know what I mean? So I don't think it's intended to be a social medium in the same way, but I think there are definitely people who have figured out some kind of magic formula to turn it into that. You know what I mean?
I almost feel like, in a way, YouTube is the future of television.
Sure.
Like when we had talked about Anchor before and how the idea behind Anchor is essentially open up radio to the public in a way that it wasn't before, you know, like it's short form, but people are allowed to voice respond to each other and it becomes a conversation. I feel like YouTube in a way is doing the same thing with media, with video, you know, it's taking, and I mean, to some degree it always has been, but more so now that I'm in it, am I noticing it? I find myself watching more and more YouTube and less television.
Sure. Do you know anything about YouTube Red at all?
I just know that it takes away the ads.
Okay, yeah, because I have never touched it, and I have no idea what it's in. I mean, I guess it's the premium service, but I'm not sure how you can take a service that's so inherently organic and turn it into a premium service without losing the organic charm that it had in the first place. You know what I mean?
And I'm not sure how the monetization works for the YouTube content creators with Thread, because all revenue that anybody makes on YouTube is through the ads.
Sure.
Which I was not aware of before. For some reason, I was always under the assumption that where the ads were and where they showed up in videos was YouTube choosing where those were and not the content creators. Which is why I only use one type of ad, and I only use the ad at the beginning of a video that you can skip after 3 seconds because it's the least obtrusive. But, you know, there's people out there that put ads in the middle of their video, pop up in the middle of their video. They put the ad where you're forced to watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
And those people are just, I can't imagine that they're making money. But I don't see how, when you're relying on those things to make the money, I'm wondering if YouTube Red compensates you. I know that they did a similar thing when they introduced, Amazon did a similar thing when they introduced Amazon Unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
For all of the independent authors that had books for sale through the Kindle, if they chose to opt into the Amazon Unlimited program, there was obviously the chance of more exposure. More people would find them. More people would give their book a chance because it was included in their $10 a month. You know, so you read whatever you want for $10 a month.
Sure.
Depending, I can't remember the specific details. I believe it was after a certain person read a certain percentage of your book, then you were compensated for that as if they bought it.
Oh, gotcha.
Which is cool, but it's also a little weird. I think that people freaked out a bit because they couldn't measure their sales in the same way. And I haven't heard anybody complain about Red.
So, well, I guess from that perspective, it turns it from a per view basis to a subscription almost. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like there's a certain limit you have to a threshold you have to cross before it becomes profitable.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
Which, I mean, and for all of those out there that wonder about how much money people make using YouTube, let's put it this way. If you're not getting millions of views, you're not making money. I think it takes, is it 1,500 or 15,000? I think it's 15,000 views to make a dollar.
Yeah, I think it's tough to gauge because it's a sliding scale. In one of the previous businesses I worked for, it was a photography blog, and we used to get between 10 to 20,000 views per video. And in some cases, because we did a few interviews with some famous photographers like Annie Leibovitz and Ansel Adams' son, about the Ansel Adams Foundation and stuff. And some of those got up to like 150,000-200,000 mark, and we barely saw any money at all. Like I think the most profitable video we ever had made us like $280, and it had like 190,000 views or something like that.
Well, I just typed it in to take a look, and gotta love there's an ad that pops up at the top of the Google search. It says, "How many views does it take to make money?" Right, and then there's this little paragraph, and the guy says, "This is how I'm able to make a dollar per 25 views." I'm like, oh. That sounds like something nobody should do.
That is a scam. Yeah, that's all kinds of bad.
Oh, it's either a scam or this guy is just tacking so many ads into his videos that he's just being an asshole.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's worth it.
Well, I think the only real way to make money for a content provider on YouTube, if you're just an individual, is to get sponsored by a company. Like I know there's I forget his name. There's a surfer guy who does that for GoPro, and because he produces content for GoPro, GoPro pays him for his views. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But that's a very direct one-to-one relationship versus what we're talking about, which is more ad revenue. You know what right? I mean?
Yeah.
So I think it's all about trying. If you really want to monetize in a place like YouTube, then I think it's about creating partnerships more than it is about getting views. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think part of the reason that I brought up the monetization, obviously, is I'm not worried about me making money on my YouTube. But I do think going forward, if YouTube is going to take at least part of the place in television, as we're talking about, there needs to be a better way for people to make money when they do it. And it can't be tied to the same system that network television is, because then it ends up just being networks, except they're not networks. You know, like there, you just have these companies that become like networks, which I've heard that people are afraid that YouTube is about to move in that direction, not on any of their company choices, but just brands are exploding onto YouTube, and they're going to smother all the small guys just by producing higher quality content.
Sure.
But I think that there's, I mean, for example, one of my current, I guess you could say, one of my current crushes is this girl named Grace Helbig, and she's a YouTube comedian, and she's quirky, she's strange, kind of everything awesome, and I can't imagine that in the quote-unquote normal mainstream media that she would be able to do a week, even a weekly show, because she's quirky enough that maybe she doesn't have enough mainstream appeal. People wouldn't dump money into her, but she's pretty damn successful on YouTube, and she's able to make money. I don't think, I wouldn't say that it's her sole source of income, but I do think that that's a huge thing to be able to open those doors up to those kinds of people.
Yeah, and I honestly think from and I don't know how true this is, because in almost every historical example I can think of, it's not been true. So I have a feeling I'm totally wrong in this. But I think like with YouTube, it's kind of there's kind of a sense of, I think it's YouTube and its users has a sense of self-awareness that I think is unique among certain websites. And I think it's kind of like Reddit in that sense, in that if you start getting too corporate, then YouTube will just backlash on you. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think that there's a strong sense of that, at least for now. And I don't know if it'll always stay this way. Like the only successful example I can think of that's still maintaining its sense of quote unquote integrity is Reddit. You know what I mean? Like if you go too corporate on Reddit, people will destroy you.
Right.
I mean, and I think that there's a certain sense of that with YouTube too, where people are almost protective of it as a medium of artistic expression and free speech. So I think that it kind of protects itself. Like one of my favorite YouTubers is this Scandinavian girl by the name of Simone Getz, and she just builds these ridiculous robots. Nice. And they're hilarious. Like she has an alarm clock robot that's basically an alarm clock hooked up to a giant rubber hand, and anytime it goes off, it just smacks you in the face.
I think I saw a thumbnail of that in the past 2 days. That's interesting.
I'm sure. I mean, she's huge now. Like I think her alarm clock machine got something like 850,000 views or something ridiculous like that. I might be totally wrong on that too, but she's a good example of a person who couldn't really produce content anywhere other than YouTube. And it's very DIY, it's very grassroots, and it's very bootstrappy. And so I think because of that, because of what YouTube's been to people like her and to most of the other videos that you find on YouTube, you don't see huge production value. You don't see anything that's too corporate or too overdone. And I think that YouTube, at least for now, has a way of self-correcting itself with that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
Right. So I feel like I guess management would be the way to say it. I don't know. Whoever runs YouTube, whatever word you want to use for that, the corporate structure of YouTube is very, very, seems to be, in my experience, very focused on their creative community.
Sure.
And I know that they regularly have meetings with, obviously, people like Grace Helbig and Casey Neistat, people that have a lot of heat on their account, and finding out ways, hey, what can we do to make this experience better? What kind of thing do you need? Okay, you need a button like that? Okay, we'll see if we can work that in. You know, like I was thinking the other day, like what would be brilliant of YouTube right now would be to steal Snapchat Snapcode. You know, you have those little yellow squares with the ghosts and people's faces in it. All those little dots around in the yellow part make up a QR code so that you scan it with a Snapchat app, you just tap on it, and boom, you've added that person to your Snapchat. Imagine if you could do that with YouTube channels.
That's true. That makes sense.
Because there is a lot involved with subscribing to a YouTube channel. You know, it's like you got to go to their site. I mean, not a lot, as in it's oppressive, but comparatively, man, that in some way probably prevents the ease with which people subscribe. Whereas if you had something like that, boom, scan it with the YouTube app, added to your subscribers.
Well, I think part of the reason why that is the way that it is because, you know, with Snapchat, it's device specific. Like, you're going to use that on a mobile device. You know what I mean? As opposed to YouTube, where you could be on a desktop, a laptop, a tablet, a phone, right, or any number of those things on any given day. So, I mean, I was thinking about that the other day too. Like, for a site like YouTube, how thorough they have to be from a design perspective and from a, you know, a functionality perspective in order to make sure that they're satisfying the needs for all of their customers on in all of those various devices. You know what I mean?
Right. And without offering the, you know, customization where it's like, oh, your page. Like, I think that's where MySpace fell apart. Mm-hmm. They offered so much customization that there was no unity and no structure to the site. And Facebook kind of.
Yeah. And that's the one thing with YouTube is that there is an aesthetic cohesion that makes it so that, I mean, and not only that, but it had to be good enough that people adopted it without getting too pissed off and leaving it. You know what I mean? And I think that, I mean, don't get me wrong. Every single time YouTube modifies its interface or tweaks its algorithm, like, people freak out for a little bit. Right. But because they've done such a good job at thinking ahead, I mean, and they don't always get it right. I mean, there's obviously examples of things that they've done throughout their historical, you know, path through their evolution that have been wrong. But for the most part, they hit the mark. And I think that because they've kept their interface so simple and because they've done what you're talking about, which is removing the illusion of choice. You know what I mean? Taking all of those, like, MySpace just became a madhouse, you know, like, it just became this basically a zoo where anyone could do whatever they wanted with their interface. And, you know, I'm sure you've had this experience, like, going to a person's MySpace page and seeing some kind of bright pink animated GIF as their background. It was just so obnoxious to look at that you just couldn't do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that YouTube, the evolution of YouTube has kind of blown my mind. And it used to be a really, really ugly site. And just the interface alone, I mean, I'm looking at it right now and I'm like, it's pretty sexy.
Yeah, and it's pretty simple. There's not a lot to it.
Yeah. I mean, they've got some great design going on just in that alone. So I think anybody that's complaining is essentially they're nitpicking.
Yeah, exactly.
And, which is fine. You know, you can nitpick about whatever you want, but let's all be grown-ups.
Yeah, like, I mean, with your vlog's a good example, actually. I think the last three episodes of your vlog that I've watched each of them on a different device, and I can't recall the experiences being different at all. You know what I mean? There's a magic to that. Like, there's definitely a very strong intelligence behind that design. You know what I mean?
And I think that consistency, and this sounds mean, but in the way, it's makes it hard to remember that they're owned by Google.
Yeah, true.
not that Google's, like, completely sloppy, but I mean, like, comparatively, YouTube just out-rocks everything that Google does, and maybe everything that Apple does, too. I mean, YouTube is just solid.
Yeah.
I mean, and you talk about the amount of traffic and the amount of people that they're dealing with and the things that are going on there, and I don't really see many problems happening, which is a testament. When a company can make something, they make a site that has that much traffic, and they become invisible, mm-hmm. they've hit a magic point where it's like, you've done something that's magic. I don't think people sit and do what we're doing right now, talk about the YouTube interface, because it's invisible. They don't think about it at all. They do still talk about Apple. They do still talk about Google. They do still talk about Android, because those things aren't at the level that YouTube's at right now.
And typically, whenever we have conversations about, you know, Google or Apple, especially the last couple of weeks, with the exception of you talking about Tim Cook standing up for the rights of all humanity, it's usually in a negative light. You know, like, I think about all of these rumors that are floating around the new MacBook Pro. I mean, because I recently just bought a PC just because it's more cost effective for what I do, and I don't need to do any complex editing anytime soon or anything like that. But, you know, the conversation now is like what they're going to change. And I think that I the new gummy keyboard or whatever it was, like, that was bugging people. You know what I mean?
People are going crazy about that. That's so.
Yeah. It's and I don't really understand the gripe. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, I like my clicky keyboards, but I've adapted to every keyboard I've ever used. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't care at all.
Yeah, I don't really care that much either. But I think it speaks to a different, like where I was going with that was I think that YouTube only changes when they really, really need to, you know what I mean? Whenever there's a core functionality that needs to be modified to improve the user experience versus companies like Google and Apple who have a tendency to just change things for the sake of them, you know what I mean?
Well, they have to, in a sense. Excuse me, I'm yawning. I think you're right. There's a difference between YouTube is it's a place, not a product.
Yeah.
Whereas Google are they're creating products. I mean, technically YouTube is one of their products, but they don't need to. Hey, here's YouTube version 7.5.
Yeah.
I don't know what version is on. Nobody knows what version on. It's very different. So you're definitely right there.
Well, it goes back to what we've talked about in the past. Like, I mean, this is from the very first podcast. I think that YouTube is the greatest example of the company, the type of company that you were describing, in that it just always works, dude. Like any regardless of what device you're on, regardless of what internet connections be. I mean, obviously you have to have some kind of connection, but as long as you have a reasonably fast internet connection, regardless of what device you're on, even if the device itself physically sucks, YouTube works. You know what I mean?
Right, which is, I mean, I think sometimes we live in this bubble where we don't realize how amazing the things around us are. The fact that it's streaming video to us wherever we are and relatively wonderful quality. I mean, like, I don't have any complaints on quality. Somebody can. It depends on your connection. Sure. But, sometimes I look at my vlogs on my phone and I'm like, it kind of looks better, smaller. Then you think about Twitter. 90% of everything that's on Twitter is text-based, which requires far less bandwidth.
Yeah.
And Twitter seems it's been a while, but Twitter seemed to crash all the time back in the day. Like, yeah. what the hell was going on there comparatively? It's like we're talking about a programming and an engineering marvel.
Yeah. And I think the only company that comes even close to them in just pure functionality is just Netflix. I mean, Netflix is the same thing. Like, I've watched Netflix on long drives, you know what I mean? Not while I'm driving, of course, because I don't want to die. But, you know, I think that the level of – and you're so right. Like, this is the reason why we never have conversations about YouTube and how it works or how it doesn't work, because it's just the ghost in the machine, you know? Anytime you could be sitting there and complaining about a new Apple device, but guess where you're going to go to watch a video on the latest feature that pisses you off? YouTube.
You know what I mean? Right.
And it just works. I mean, it's fascinating to me.
That's the beauty of it too, is you have large companies putting things on YouTube. You have, you know, late night with the, it's not called late night anymore. It's Tonight Show with Jimmy Kimmel. No, not Jimmy Kimmel. Damn it.
Yeah.
Jimmy Fallon. I'm all over the place. You've got him and John Oliver putting, you know, HBO and John Oliver putting stuff up on YouTube. And then you've got the guy down the street that's using, like, the camera on a flip phone from, like, 1998. And they're putting stuff up, too. And it's open to everybody. And that's pretty rad.
Yeah, I mean, the guy down the street might get more views on his video than Jamie Oliver's. You know what I mean?
Yep.
I think one of the fascinating things about YouTube is that it's one of the few places left in the digital world, or just the world in general, where there's a level playing field. You know, whether you're Tesla and going to spend $10 million on a commercial, or you're some random kid on a skateboard with a flip phone, like, you have an equally high chance of getting a large number of views if your content's just compelling. You know,
right? And I think that in some way we can go back to the Instagram thing with this. I don't think anybody ever complains about YouTube having an algorithm. And they do. They have an algorithm. When you go to your homepage, when you go to that recommended thing, that's an algorithm. The reason nobody complains about it is probably because nobody uses it. We just literally hunt for things exactly what we want until we find it. Or we go directly to the person that we're subscribing to and watch their most recent update. At least that's how I use it.
Sure.
You know, I get to the end of the day on the iPhone app. I usually end up watching it on the iPhone app, even though I have it on Apple TV. Because there's just a little head for, you know, like the 10 people I'm subscribed to, and it'll tell me how many, you know, say like three next to Casey Neistat, but okay, I haven't watched his last three vlogs. Boom. Play. And I just watch those three, and it's great.
You know, actually, lately I've been using that front page a lot more, like over the last couple of months, and watching videos that YouTube is picking for me, and it actually does a really good job of it.
It does, actually. It does better than Netflix, like we talked about before. You know, like I was just looking at my Netflix recommendations yesterday. I'm like, 80%, I'm never going to watch this. I mean, Chloe Deschanel's hot, but I'm never going to watch her sitcom. Never. I have no interest in that. But it's recommended to me. By the way, go on a small tangent on Netflix. Maybe you could solve a mystery to me that I think is hilarious. Popular on Netflix is a category, and trending on Netflix is also a category. What minor esoteric definition makes those different?
Well, from a web perspective, I remember when we were dealing with websites, the difference was trending is more current or urgent, and popular is historical.
Hmm.
So that was the only difference that I... For example, like if something got 50,000 views in the last hour versus 250,000 views over the last year, you know what I mean?
That makes a bit of difference there.
So that for me, when we were dealing with website analytics, was how we dealt with it. Trending was much more like, okay, so how many people viewed this in the last 3 days versus how many people have viewed it in total over the last 4 years, you know?
That makes a lot of sense. I was looking at that, I'm like, and the sad thing is, it's like 80%, at least as far as Netflix did it, like 80% of the things in each category were the same.
Yeah, that makes sense. If you're watching like Friends or something, then it's probably going to be in both, you know?
Right. Or you scroll down and it says, you know, new releases and, new releases. And what's the other one? New something. It's like newly added. That's it. New releases and newly added. Sometimes they're the same thing. Hey, what are you reading right now? Anything interesting?
I am reading a book called The Blueprint to Death. I don't remember it. I don't have it with me. I should remember to do those things. Like, I think for the next podcast, I was actually thinking about doing this yesterday, but like pulling up the three artists that I'm listening to, the book that I'm reading, and the movie that I'm currently watching. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think we should probably include that for the next podcast. A Blueprint for the Afterlife, that's what it's called. And I'm just barely into it thus far. But it was based off another book that our friend Emily had suggested to us, and I forget the name of that one too. So I'm very ill prepared for that question. I will have both of those things for next week. It's called The Sum of Something or Other, and it's analyzing death in a very different way. I don't know why, but the last couple of weeks I've been thinking about my mortality a lot, and it's maybe because I'm getting up to 40 and thinking about dying. But, you know, I definitely will include those. I think that's an entire conversation in and of itself. But yeah, I will throw those, into the next podcast. I've got a whole bunch of things to ask you about that too. Yeah, because we're both at that age where many, many things are changing in both of our lives, and many different choices are coming upon us. So that's an interesting conversation.
That's definitely something I would like to steer us into with our future podcasts, is getting into what we're reading and listening to more often. Because I think at a certain point we're gonna hit a block with our complaints about technology. There's more children playing more children playing on my lawn. They love my lawn. I don't know.
Well, what are you listening to these days? I'm always curious as to what music's spinning around.
Today you're going to get the most peculiar answer that you were not expecting, too, which may require a bit of explanation so that I don't look like a total strange person. I've been listening to Native American chant music.
Whoa, that's a weird one.
Yeah. So basically, there's a application on the iPhone called Omvana. Omvana is a guided meditation app, you know, and I am not at the, like I said earlier with the Strides app, I'm trying to remind myself to meditate every day. I am not at the point where I can meditate by myself in silence. So I need a guide. I need a guided meditation. I need something to make me sit there for 15 minutes or, you know, whatever, however long I choose. And the way the Omvana application works, which I actually recommend, it's very cool. You have audio tracks, voice tracks, I should say, you know, with the guided meditation of, or some of them are just talks, not even guided meditation. You go into the mixer and you have that. And then in the level above that, there's, you swap through backing.
And I feel like film is the most difficult medium because film requires cooperation.
Sure.
And it requires more people than you can imagine, and organizing teams and having a guy to organize that team. It's a corporate structure every time you make a film.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you can make a film by yourself, sure, but you can't make the Avengers by yourself.
Oh man, think about some of the projects that we've worked on with our friends, no less. I mean, some of those projects are pretty far-reaching in scope, and just the amount of logistical nightmare that's required just to get 20 people in the same place at the same time is pretty remarkable.
Right, like the Kung Fu Vampire video we did.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking that one too. Just thinking about how difficult it was just to figure out how to get, you know, three different vehicles worth of people from one location to the next because we had to shoot that in such a short period of time.
Or when we were trying to get the smoke up behind Shannon and Nick, and Matt and I were laying on the ground where you couldn't see us trying to fan the smoke machine up.
And yeah, or having you crawl out of the floor. Remember that? Oh, that escapade? My back.
That would destroyed my back. But you know, it was all worth it. It ended up being a great video, and it was so great that Korn ripped it off on their most recent video.
Yeah, so thanks, Korn, for taking
it. With doubt. Go into it with enthusiasm. Be like, I have worked for 30 years at drawing, and this is how far I've come. And it's an incredible exercise. It really is. With writing, with anything. I mean, like, even, you know, like with golf, Lamb. Think about the kid who first picked up that golf club. When you go out and you are at the driving range, give that kid a minute to watch what you're doing.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because I think that golf has actually taught me to do that very, very well. Golf is probably the most it's the most Asimov I've ever gotten in my life. In the sense that I know exactly how hard it's been. And I think a lot of it is because of how ruthlessly dedicated I was to it. I realize exactly how hard it's been. I realize exactly what steps I needed to take to get there. And I know exactly what I'm capable of. Like I realize I'm a pretty decent golfer, but I also know very clearly what it is that I need to do next in order to become that much better. And there's a ruthless discipline that comes along from it that makes it so that I've learned this in other parts of my life. And yeah, so I do take that backward glance quite a bit. I take stock of how far I've come, and I'll stand there and I'll smack my 8-iron and I'll think of, you know, those first early days. And I think it's helpful that I teach too as well. So I think this is a good lesson for most other people is that, you know, if you're really, really good at something, try to share it, try to teach it, try to show other people what joy or what benefits they can get out of it. And in doing so, you remind yourself of how much you got out of it and how important it was to you and how special it is that you can get good at something or that you can value something to that degree or create something even.
And that's the Asimov lesson, right?
Absolutely.
He could have kept all the science that he learned to himself. Instead, he wrote over 500 books.
Good God.
I mean, that's about as generous as you can get. I mean, the guy got as close to opening up a vein and pouring it into somebody's mouth as you possibly can get.
Jeez. I mean, you think about the effect that he has on science and society and how many I'll put it to you this way. For anyone who's listening to this podcast, read enough Asimov, like read the Foundation series, you know, read the Robot series, read the Empire series, read a bunch of the short stories, and then go back and think about every piece of science fiction you've ever read or watched since Asimov wrote those. And you'll see how
famous for being supposedly rich. So we've elected a movie star as a governor of California before. twice, actually, because Ronald Reagan was governor of California, and Ronald Reagan was president as well. So there's a huge, I think that there's a huge gap in cultural difference there, too.
Sure.
And the connection that England has with Shakespeare, it's still very much an important part of their culture, it seems. You know, obviously we're not English, we can't say for sure, but it sure seems that way from here.
Yeah, and I, you know, if the Macbeth video that I implore everyone who listens to this podcast to go listen to it, it's going to be in the show notes. Listen to the reverence in McKellen's voice as he's talking about that speech. I mean, it's not a very long speech. It's you know, maybe 150 words, but they're spectacular in their form, and the care that he goes through each word with, and even the description that you had about him telling Patrick Stewart, you know, what the most important word in that entire speech is. You can tell that. That's not a joke. That's not a joke throwaway line that he's telling to Patrick Stewart. If you go through that video where he's talking about that speech, he describes that particular part of the speech for a good minute.
And what's interesting is in his description of that as a young man, he doesn't mention that advice that he gave to Patrick Stewart.
Yeah,
so you almost have to wonder if, you know, all of these decades of that ruminating in his head, that wisdom came out of rumination, not from his actual prep for the performance he did back in the day.
Yeah, but you could see the genesis of the thought, though, because you know, in talking about the tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, he mentions how the word tomorrow in its repetition makes it almost meaningless, and so of course the word and the emphasis on the word and would actually have a lot more weight in that particular portion of the speech. It makes sense. It just seems like it was what we heard was the deduction, and what he said to Patrick Stewart was the conclusion.
And what's brilliant about the way that he talks about that interpretation, well, there's a lot of things about it that are quite brilliant, but it says a lot about acting as a whole, in the sense that that is the way that he has reasoned out, and he tells you everything that he's reasoned out. It tells you how his Macbeth is, but then you can bring somebody else in and they can do Macbeth and reason all of those meanings differently and have a completely different performance. It doesn't mean he's reasoned correctly. And that's why acting is such an amazing thing, because you can have characters that are played over and over again. Sherlock Holmes has been played by over 130 people.
Wow. Didn't know that.
130. From Christopher Lee, who was Saruman in Lord of the Rings, to Robert Downey Jr. and Benedict Cumberbatch, and as we said, Ian McKellen. It's incredible. I think even Peter O'Toole played him at once. Basil Rathbone was one of the most famous. He was, I think, the first film representation, other than Buster Keaton. Sherlock Jr., I think, was the name of that movie.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
But it's interesting, because if you go through, if you actually sat and watched all the Sherlocks, sure, some of them are going to be awful. And I guarantee you all of the ones that are awful are because they're playing too much off of somebody else's performance that came before.
Sure.
And I know that the Basil Rathbone was a hard one for a lot of people to follow, because he was like, he had epitomized it. And that's the same thing with Macbeth. So McKellen is bringing these interpretations to these lines, and it goes back to exactly what you said. The care that's put into this craft, to look at this, to analyze these lines. What does this mean? Why would he be saying this? But he also, like he says in there, he says the job of the actor is not only to represent what the character is feeling, but also to represent what the author is expressing. You have to keep both of those minds alive. And that's a very different interpretation of acting. The method is completely opposite of that.
Sure. And to hear his description of, you know, that speech and what it was supposed to mean, and saying that, you know, to him, Shakespeare was talking about time, you know, the meaninglessness of time, under the circumstance. I mean, just the level of diving you have to go, the amount of understanding that you have to have, and the homework that you have to do to understand a piece of literature that clearly, or to interpret it with that level of confidence, is just telling of, you're right, I think it's a generational thing as well. I mean, if you look at guys within that class, it's just a level of dedication to the craft that is unique, that and maybe there are actors today that do have that level of dedication towards their craft, but maybe the environment's just different. You know, we don't respect actors in the same way that we used to, and so because of that, we don't appreciate the work it takes to create and then give those characters life on screen. But you can definitely, I wish there was more stuff like that. You know, I wish there were more things. Like if we were to talk to the late great Heath Ledger about what it took for him to construct the Joker the way that he did, I wonder if we would have that same feeling as we would have with Ian McKellen talking about, there I go with the extra L again, with Ian McKellen talking about, the interpretation of that speech.
Actually, interesting that you would bring up Heath Ledger, because that would be one of the examples where I would say yes. People don't know this. There's actually on Netflix. It's funny that I talked about like wanting to get rid of these things, but I keep referencing things that are on them. It's presented like a TV show, but it's not really a TV show. It's presented like a TV show within Netflix. It's called Too Young to Die, and it's all shorter documentaries about artists who died young. But they're all the documentaries are made by different people. That's why I say it's not really a TV show. The first one is on Heath Ledger, and what you find out is that there was journals and journals of him reasoning out the Joker and creating that role.
Wow.
On that list, I would also have put Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, sure.
I believe
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yep, that was the third one I was going to say too. We're on the same wavelength. And maybe Johnny Depp at times.
Sure.
But yeah, it's a very different thing. It's a craft to them. And I always have problems with those words, art and craft. And yeah. I'm not sure yet I understand what the difference between the two is. They seem to be interchangeable when you want to. But in this case, I mean craft as a compliment. It's something that they have honed. McKellen is a master actor.
Yeah, I feel like part of the reason why, because I have the same problems with those words too, and quite a few others when it comes to creative stuff, because I feel like there's a certain sense of pretension that just kind of oozes from them when said in the wrong, way or said in the wrong context. And I feel like if you look at a guy like McKellen, and you asked him, about his craft, there wouldn't be a sense of pride about it. In the same way that we would expect for a man of his stature, his level of success, I get the sense that he would just say that the craft is ever changing in him. You know, that it's ever growing in him, and as he changes as a person, the craft does too, because the craft is a part of him. And I think that in researching this article, this podcast, the thing that really sticks out to me and the lesson that I really take away from it is, in order to really create, in order to create what you are fully capable of creating as an artist, it can't just be something you do. It has to be who you are, and that to me is so clear in his just amazing repertoire of stuff. The 50 years worth of stuff that he's done that has single-handedly changed a good portion of the stage work in England and quite a bit here in the U.S. as well. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think that's one of the huge differences, perhaps, between the two types of acting we're talking about. A lot of these actors that we're not giving specific names to, that were kind of disparaging, they're essentially they're celebrities who act.
Yeah,
that's the way the world views them. That's the way they view themselves. Ian McKellen is an actor who has achieved some fame, But his job is to act, and there's like a blue collar work ethic to it.
Sure.
In the sense that, you know, it's like, okay, this is my job. This is what I go do, and oh, I need to prepare for this, and it's a different way of thinking, I believe. It's subtle perhaps for some of you, but those of you who understand what we mean, I think you can feel that.
Yeah, and there's definitely a workmanship that's obvious when you look at certain actors. I mean, the one that immediately pops to mind is Gary Oldman. You know, even I remember the first thing I ever saw of Gary Oldman was The Professional. And from that day forward, I was like, whatever this guy does, I'm going to watch regardless of what it is. Because you could tell that there was such care put into constructing his character. And yeah, so I think if pressed, most people could tell who really cares and who doesn't.
Yeah, there's some actors have the ability to move you. And that's from that work done. I was just rewatching Contact last night, the Jodie mm-hmm. Foster sci-fi movie.
Yep.
It's not a great movie, but I've always enjoyed it. But there's a scene at the end where she's in front of, I assume it's like Congress, they don't really say, trying to explain what has occurred. And the camera goes in close on her face. And I mean, her acting's been passable the whole movie. But there's that one scene. There's so much humanity in her face and the way her eyes look and everything that all of a sudden it goes from being acting into what we're talking about.
Sure.
You know, the rest of the movie she'd been acting, but in that moment, she became that character.
Yeah, I know what scene you're talking about too. There's such anguish in her face.
And it's very subtle too. You know, it's like she's not overacting. It's just, and I think that only comes from the kind of care that we're talking about, because it's not something that you can plan for. It's something you have to embody that character in a way that so that their emotion is coming out of you even beyond your control. And people, some actors are able to achieve that if they're lucky in one scene in a movie. Or if they're somebody like Ian McKellen for a whole role.
Man, I really have to watch this Sherlock. I'm so intrigued. I'm annoyed that I haven't seen it. Yeah, I'm trying to think of more modern examples, more actors that I can think of that have pulled off that moment, you know, that singular scene of just poignant, amazing work that transcends the project itself. Because you're right. I mean, Contact wasn't a great movie. It wasn't a bad movie by any stretch, but it wasn't a great one either. But that 2.5 or 3 minutes or whatever it is at the very end of the movie when Jodie Foster's on that witness stand is almost career defining in its reality.
I can give you one more. It's a very small. It's in a movie that I think is actually awful. What was it called? Darn it. It's the Johnny Depp movie where him and John Turturro. John Turturro is the writer who really wrote the thing, Secret Window or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was a horrible movie.
Was that what it's called, Secret Window?
I don't remember. I remember watching it, though. Yeah.
Oh, anyways, the movie is not very good, but there's one part where Johnny Depp is talking on the phone. And number one, it's one of the few times in a movie where I saw somebody talking on a phone and I'm like, that's the way somebody would actually talk on the phone. You know, there's appropriate pauses for the other person on the other end of the line to respond. But then there's this part where I think he's like eating Cheetos or something like that. And he starts kind of like grabbing at the air because there's like this gnat that's going around him. There's no gnat there. But that little thing that he did right there, it brought that moment alive. And it's probably the only reason to watch the movie, which you probably can't do anyways because I can't remember the title.
Yeah, so you're never going to find it. Well, just remember that John Turturro and Johnny Depp are in it and you'll probably somehow pull it off.
Which should have made it great, right? so I think maybe I challenged you to write what you think of Mr. Holmes. I think what will also be good is for both of us maybe to do, for the supplemental material, maybe do a list of like five roles that hit that moment that we're talking about.
Or even five scenes.
Sure. Five roles, even.
I'm trying to think of, for example, the one that comes to me. It's in a brilliant movie, of course. I mean, Seven is one of my favorite movies of all time. But Brad Pitt's reaction to the "What's in the box" scene at the very end is so gut wrenching and hard to watch almost because of how real it feels. That's a good one to find those five scenes for each of us, or five performances that define that.
All right, so guys, look out for that. What are we going to do our next episode on?
I don't know.
We've done a musician before this one. This is an actor. Before that, we had a director, right?
Yeah, we've had an author in there. Yeah, in Asimov.
And two authors, yeah. Because we have a commie.
I've been kind of itching to do another musician, and in particular, I've been really itching to do Bob Dylan for some reason. I don't know why.
Well, it would be kind of appropriate considering he just won the Nobel Prize.
Exactly. So I felt like that would be perfect.
Well, you heard it here. Next episode, Robert Zimmerman.
Solid.